Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world is coming, tell you why. There's a better world is coming, tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world is coming, tell you why. There's a better world is coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world is coming, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, welcome to Progressive News Network. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network, bringing you progressive voices from across the state and beyond. I'd like to welcome my co-host, longtime activist and progressive, Mr. Luis Cuevas. Welcome, Luis.
Hey, how are you, Rick?
Very good, sir. Very good.
Excellent.
Well, I've got some news stories for you, so everybody buckle in and open the eyebrows. Here it comes. First thing I want to let you know is there's a Veggie Pride Parade in New York City. It takes place the 24th of March. Make sure you find out about that. PDA is having a conference call. Contact your local PDA rep. It's going to be called On the Healthcare Issue, Come to the Call. And it's going to be Tuesday afternoon. Get your details from your local PDA rep. There's a lot of news going on, folks. Just a couple segments I want to get to right away. First, there's been some progress on the Bradley Manning case. I was recently in an interview with Glenn Greenwald on Amy Goodman's show. And the issue of transcripts. Glenn comments that the Manning case is more secretive even than the good people down in Guantanamo Bay. Glenn says it's completely connected to the decision last week. The Democratic-led Congress passed a law essentially authorizing massive new surveillance powers, allowing the U.S. government to surveil and eavesdrop on the conversation of American citizens without warrants. Instantly, the ACLU filed a lawsuit saying that this law, major new eavesdropping draw, is unconstitutional. And they got all kinds of journalists and activists, human rights groups, to say the mere existence of an eavesdropping power severely harms them. 5 years later, the Supreme Court says, because this eavesdropping program is shrouded in secrecy, no one can prove they're being subjected to the eavesdropping, and therefore, nobody has the standing to sue. And it happens over and over again. Even a former Clintonista, Mr. Podesta, says to President Obama, show us the papers. John Podesta, chairman of the Center for American Progress and a visiting professor of law at Georgetown University. He served as President Bill Clinton's chief of staff from 1998 to 2001. He says, from Attorney General Eric Holder's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee last week, we learned the Obama administration is struggling with how to provide more information on the so-called targeted killing program. Senior officials have talked about a greater need for transparency about the program, and that we will hear the president speak about this in the future. After a limited document review by the Senate Intelligence Committee, a spirited 13-hour filibuster led by Senator Ron Paul, and a last-minute admission by Holder, the president does not have the authority to use drones to kill a U.S. citizen on American soil who is not engaged in combat, the White House is still bobbing and weaving on whether to share with Congress the legal opinions and memorandums governing targeted killing, which include the legal justification for killing U.S. citizens without trial. The Obama administration, he says, is wrong to withhold these documents from Congress and the American people. He says, as a former White House chief of staff who understands the instinct to keep sensitive information secret and out of public view, it's beyond dispute that some information must be closely held to protect national security and to engage in effective diplomacy, and that unauthorized disclosure can be extraordinarily harmful. But protecting technical means, human sources, operational details, intelligence, cannot be used as an excuse for creating secret law to guide our institutions. In refusing to release to Congress the rules and justifications governing a program that has conducted nearly 400 unmanned drone strikes and killed at least 3 Americans in the last 4 years, President Obama is ignoring the system of checks and balances that's governed our country from the earliest days. By the way, all the information that we go over, all the news stories that we try to cover each show, can be found at averyvoice.blogspot.com. All the details on the shows, details on the guests, etc. So please check it out avryvoice.blogspot.com. There's so much information there. I urge you to read the story as it's posted. Also, since the first time since 1948, propaganda is now legal in the U.S. Hey, isn't that some progress, huh? President Obama signed H.R. 4310. Look it up. The 2013 National Defense Authorization Act, Section 1078. It's another one to remember, 1078. The bill authorized the use of propaganda inside the United States, which had been previously been banned since 1948 when the Smith-Mundt Act, we all know, of course, the Smith-Mundt Act, and the history of 78 is just too shocking to hear, but we'll go on to say that BP, by the way, is appealing the compensation ruling. Oh, my God, poor dears are asked to spend some money, you know, on people and the environment. BP is asked a judge on Friday to temporarily halt claims paid out as business economic losses, saying they were fictitious. They were absurd. Such charges. Poor BP.
My God.
In a filing in federal court in New Orleans, BP said it could be irreparably harmed, not like the Gulf, because the payouts could cost billions more than it's budgeted when it agreed to a settlement last April.
Oh,
my. BP's appealing the March 4th ruling that upheld the way it's paying business claimants seeking compensation. Okay, by the way, there's this news from a fellow progressive broadcaster, Harry Shearer. He mentioned in the recent report by the, this was a report on the reconstruction in Iraq. Inspector General says that on average, in over the last 9 years, now this is not costing, this is not war costs, this is strictly reconstruction costs. He pegs it at $15 million a day for 9 years, ladies and gentlemen. You have been paying $15 million a day just for reconstruction. Gosh, one can only imagine what the war costs actually were. Then, of course, there's the mercenaries, there's the kickbacks, there's the war profiteering. I bet that's probably more than $15 million a day. Isn't that nice? Okay, there's more active soldiers. Active duty soldiers dying from suicide than from combat, 349 just last year. The number of prescriptions for Ritalin and Alderol written for active duty soldiers have increased 1,000% in the last 5 years. For every active duty service member who dies in battle, 25 veterans die by suicide. Only 1% of Americans have served in the Middle East, but veterans of combat make up 20% of all suicides in the U.S. The suicide rate of active duty soldiers in the Civil War was only 9 to 15 per 100,000 soldiers. Suicide rate of active duty U.S. soldiers in the Middle East is 23 per 100,000. Casualty rates were far higher in the Civil War, meaning the Civil War was more psychologically traumatic. In the Korean War, the suicide rate among active duty military soldiers was only 11 per 100,000. To date, the Pentagon has spent more than $1 billion on psychiatric drugs, making it one of the largest consumers of Big Pharma. Okay. And by the way, I drafted a little letter to Senator Nelson, who's telling us all the wonderful things that he's doing. I mentioned another senator to him, Senator Warren. I said, by the way, Senator Elizabeth Warren has been asking tough questions of the Treasury Department of Justice and the various regulators who've had the responsibility for overseeing banks. Ever heard of the HSBC? And asking under what conditions they might actually, you know, prosecute a bank or a Wall Street firm? HSB has been in the news. Maybe you've heard. They were laundering drug cartel money, trading with nations against whom we have sanctions. Terrorist nations, Iran, Somalia, Yemen, etc. Surely there was a fine, but no actual prosecutions. So where were you, Senator Nelson, when the freshman senator was getting around the usual pass the buck? We're hoping to get hired by these guys run around. And you say you're investigating seniors and the issues on aging? Oh, that's nice. When were you going to stand up to the cuts in Medicare and Medicaid? I know I'm waiting. When are you going to stand up against not just the cuts, but the COLA for seniors? Saying that you're investigating is very nice. Doing something to actually help is so much better. Please, Senator, save the platitudes for the hard of hearing. We who actually watch what you're doing, we see you're huddling on the Senate floor with the Republicans. When are you going to quit studying senior issues and actually do something for these seniors? Don't just tell me you're studying senior issues. If you don't know that we're hurting, maybe you should start buying cat food. Well, ladies and gentlemen, That and more we'll probably try to get to in the break. Also, lots of bad news on the Fukushima front. You know, they're just about ready to admit that there is no containment whatsoever of any of those plants over there. And that fish showing up not only in the waters of Japan, but also the waters of California.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we've got some reports. Next week, we're going to do a special on the Fukushima seminar held by the Caldecott people, where many, many nuclear scientists, health physicists get together and talk about the damage we all are going to suffer from the Fukushima. And now, ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, I'd like to bring in our first guest, the charming and talented Faith Babas, who's going to talk about issues relating to accessibility. Faith, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, my dear, very good. We want to welcome you to Progressive News Network. I've got my co-host with me tonight also. You may know Luis Cuevas from Progressive Push.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, and welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Faith, you've done some really wonderful things on the accessibility issue. That video you made is wonderful, and there's going to be a link to it on the site. But why don't you tell us about what you've been working on the accessibility front?
Well, for me, obviously, this is a personal issue. I was born with a disability, so these are things that I have faced my entire life. And it's just discouraging to really not see things change. Having grown up with a disability and now being an adult and well into adulthood, to still be facing some of the same challenges that I faced when I was younger. So that's really kind of what prompted the video that here we are, 2013, 23 years after the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and not a whole lot has changed. So I'm kind of a novice, really, with Movie Maker, so I was really pleased with the way the video had turned out. I got a lot of positive feedback from a lot of people that kind of helped me with the edits, but I just kind of hope to really raise people's awareness with some of the challenges that face the disabled community. A lot of people just don't think about these issues. You know, if you're not in a wheelchair in your downtown area, you're not thinking about the fact, oh, that door's not wide enough for a wheelchair to fit through, or, you know, there's two or three steps to get into the building and how that might impact somebody that is in a wheelchair. So I think really just one of the key things is just to make people a lot more aware of these situations and how little really has been done to fix these problems.
Well, Faith, let me ask you a question. Is there any entity, federal or state, that actually enforces those guidelines?
Unfortunately, the way the Americans with Disabilities Act was written, everyone refers to it as this landmark, wonderful law, and in some capacities it really is. It really did, or was supposed to change things for people with disabilities. Unfortunately, it was designed to really not be enforced very well. Enforcement really is up to the EEOC, regardless of whether it's an employment dispute or not. Anybody that is pursuing any type of challenge to it on the federal level has to file a complaint with the EEOC, which is overburdened, understaffed, especially now with sequester. They've faced layoffs themselves. Their hands are really tied as far as what they can do. When you do file a complaint, which is, it's an onerous task. I've had to file them myself, and you almost need like a law degree to try and navigate all the paperwork and everything involved. Unfortunately, a lot really doesn't get done unless a business has several complaints against them. Most of the time, they don't face fines. They may get a warning and be told that they have, you know, 90 days or whatever time they designate as being appropriate for whatever type of changes they need to make. But a lot of times businesses would rather face the fines because they know that there's not a very strong likelihood that they will be fined, and sometimes the fines are less than what the modifications are to their building for the cost for that. So unfortunately, you know, it was a landmark case in that it is designed to make buildings a lot more accessible for people with disabilities, but it really doesn't give us any leeway to challenge businesses within the courts and really to kind of seek damages for businesses that even 23 years later still don't want to make those changes.
Faith, could you help people who are unaware of the various barriers that people with disabilities face?
Well, there's, you know, a wide breadth of types of disabilities, so it really depends on the person.
I think most people think they're thinking stops at ramps. And,
right.
And from doorways to handles to buttons, I mean, there's just a whole range of things. If you could help people understand some of that, that would be wonderful.
Well, like I said, there's a wide breadth as far as the types of disabilities that were meant to be covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So a wide margin of it is for people that have physical disabilities. So it does include the wheelchair ramps and the widths of doors and elevators, depending on how many floors a building has and how old the building is. It really does get kind of complicated, but, I mean, it also allows for stipulations for people that are blind or deaf to have interpreters or to have, like, everybody's been to the ATM where even at the drive-up ATM you see Braille on the buttons, and it's always kind of the running joke of why is there Braille on a drive-up ATM, but the buttons are manufactured that way, so they are on every ATM. It's little things like that as well. So it really is designed to cover a wide range of disabilities to accommodate people with varying disabilities. So it does get kind of complicated, especially when you get into buildings that are grandfathered in, and then you're talking about historic areas and, you know, what kind of accommodations can you make without affecting the structure and the just kind of historic nature of a historic area. And then there's also waivers for people that businesses will say that, you know, the accommodations are too expensive, so they don't necessarily have to make them if EEOC agrees with them. A lot of times they can get by with that as well. So there really are a lot of kind of in this scenario, yes, and in this scenario, maybe type things that are in the ADA, and it really is kind of a complicated, convoluted document.
No, I understand. My wife is a kitchen designer, interior designer, and there's extensive regulation that they have to observe, but I can imagine a lot of reasons that these things are ignored by a lot of people who are inconsiderate. Do you want to talk about what particular situation you faced that kind of got you motivated beyond your normal progressive activism to put this video together?
Well, I've run into problems, and I'm speaking mostly for ADA, and, you know, states vary on what their regulations are. You know, if you're in a state like California, which is great, it's a lot more accessible than some of the other states. But I'm focusing more on the federal level because I do think that we should have a national minimum of you have to meet these guidelines. I shouldn't feel compelled to have to pack up and move to California in order to live my life. But I run into situations, I've lived in several different states, and just recently, actually, two of my interns that work with me were in the vagina monologues at their university, and I wasn't able to attend because where they were holding the event on the campus was not accessible, even though it was an event that was open to the public. Lately, I run into situations with hotels offering valet parking. And they're using the disabled spots as valet. So not only are you taking the spaces from people that are supposed to get to park there for free, so you're charging them now to use those spaces because you're saying, okay, well, I'll just park the car for you, and then you're not having to walk that long distance. Well, in my circumstance, that still doesn't work for me because I have a modified car. So I can't just let the valet hop in my car and drive the car. It's designed specifically for me to drive, and it can be switched over for somebody else to drive, and that's fine. I'll do that with my husband or another family member, but I'm not going to let a stranger drive my car with all this modified equipment. So we run into several situations with that where, you know, it's really kind of being misused, or they're kind of using that as an excuse not to have disabled parking. So that's been some of the more recent ones. I faced just times where it was just blatant, absolute discrimination. When I was in college, there was a bus that commuted between the two main campuses. And I attended school up north. So it was cold. It was like negative 20 outside one day. And
wow.
The bus that came up, I kind of waved at him to let him know, hi, I'm here. Come let the wheelchair ramp down because the lift was in the back of the bus. And he kind of shook his head no at me. And I'm going, okay, well, maybe the lift is broken, because it does happen from time to time.
Sure.
So he proceeded to let other students onto the bus and even actually let some of them go to the back of the bus and sit on the floor, which is illegal, and that's where the wheelchair is supposed to go. And he left. And like I said, it's negative 20 outside. I'm sitting out here freezing. There's no building really close by where I can kind of sneak in and get inside to the warmth while I'm waiting for the next bus. So I'm sitting out here freezing. The next bus got there about 10 minutes later, and he didn't have a lift, which they're not required to have all of them with wheelchair lifts. It has to be like a certain percentage of their fleet. So he got there, and he kind of gave me a confused look. Well, why didn't the other guy pick you up? And I said, oh, well, I just kind of assumed that the lift was broken. And it turned out that the lift was not broken. He just didn't want to get off his warm bus to come put me on the lift in order to get me to the other campus. And I pretty much ended up missing my class that day. I waited outside for about 30 minutes where I just couldn't stand it anymore. And that was really when I kind of found out how deficient the Americans with Disabilities Act was, in that I couldn't sue them. This was blatant discrimination. He didn't want to do what he was legally required to do, but I couldn't touch this business. The only thing that I was allowed to do, and I read it myself just because I couldn't believe how could we have not allowed people that are blatantly discriminated against based on disability to seek damages in court for situations like this. But it's absolutely not in there. And the only thing I could do was file a complaint with the EEOC, which I did. And we had like a mediation, and it was one of those, oh, well, he shouldn't have done that, and we'll make sure it doesn't happen again. But nothing happened to him. He wasn't suspended. He wasn't fired. Just kind of went on like nothing had ever happened. So, you know, obviously that made me angry. And, you know, I mean, I can understand why a lot of people with disabilities just kind of give up, you know, because it is frustrating to have those situations occur and feel like you can't do anything about it.
One of the things that you told me earlier was that there is not a ready scheme or a simple way of coordinating the needs of various disability communities so that you can present a larger united face to whether it be the state government or local government or federal government. I guess between funding limitations and other things, it's pretty hard to do that.
Right. I found that, I mean, for obvious reasons, the disabled community can be one of the hardest to try and organize, just because you do run into mobility problems of trying to get everybody into one spot, and there's issues with transportation and building accessibility, and there really isn't. I mean, there's a few organizations that do represent all people with disabilities, but they're not throughout every single state. There's a lot of groups that only represent people with very, very specific disabilities. So you have the deaf community that's looking out for the deaf community, and then you have groups that are focused on autism. So there isn't really a very broad group that's looking out for just in general people with disabilities that's been successful in organizing people, and that's kind of been a frustration. One of my biggest examples of that is that you have a lot of groups, especially now after the war in Iraq and, you know, ongoing in Afghanistan, you have a lot of injured vets that are coming back. And I have the utmost sympathy for anybody that is reentering our society with a disability, having lived with it my entire life. I would not wish that on anybody. And I have the utmost respect for the military. My entire family is military. I've had pretty much a family member that has been in almost every branch. But unfortunately, they come back and they're fighting for rights for disabled vets and not the entire disabled community. And that's very frustrating to me, that here we are fighting over the same resources and kind of trying to get a leg up on other people that have been dealing with this their entire lives. And there's just, I would really like to see that kind of incorporated more into not just a fight for injured vets. I mean, I do think we should be taking care of them. They did fight for our country. But at the same time, I think we should be looking out for all of our citizens that have had to deal with these types of circumstances, regardless of how their injury occurred, or maybe it just wasn't an injury. Like in my case, I was born with a disability. So I don't think we should be trying to elevate one group above the other. I think this would be so much better if we would have just a coordinated effort looking out for everybody with a disability and making sure that entire community is taken care of.
Luis, do you have any questions?
Yes. One of the things that I've been looking into over the years, and we're talking about accessibility, is the problem with homeowners associations, since they are always looking at maintaining what they call certain quality conditions for neighborhoods, even though there are laws governing the housing for people with disabilities. What have you encountered? Have you encountered any problems with the HOAs?
Not so much with HOAs. I mean, in the house that I had in Florida, we did have one, but there wasn't really like a common type
okay.
area. Most of the houses were new builds. I did have a wheelchair ramp that we put at the front door, and it actually kind of, it was just kind of a happy accident, really, that it kind of matched the colors of our house. But
okay.
no one really said anything to us about it, so my personal experience hasn't. I haven't had
okay.
any conflict with them, but I have had issues where, you know, unfortunately, you have 54 million Americans with a disability.
Yeah.
70% of them, I think it's closer to 75%, are actually unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
Only 22% of them make over $40,000 a year. But whenever we move, like when we moved to where I'm currently at in Virginia, we had to make the modifications to the
mm-hmm.
house that we're renting, and the homeowner had to let us make those modifications, and it ended up being positive for us because his wife actually has a disability. So, I mean, they're familiar
mm-hmm.
with all the laws, and we're more
okay.
than willing to let us make those changes. But they're also very aware of disability law and knew that they didn't have to furnish those changes.
Right.
So even though it's their house and it's not something that I can take with me when I move, I still had to pay to make those modifications for their house. And unfortunately, you know, equipment for disabilities can be very expensive.
Yes.
We had to pay $500 to put a ramp in for me to be able to access the house.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, in an apartment complex, we run into the same problem. When I was in school, we had to fight the apartment complex to put in a disabled parking space that was in front of my apartment so I could get in and out. We had to fight with them to get them to let me put in a ramp from the sidewalk, you know, in the parking lot so I could get to the apartment. So it was still kind of an argument with them, even though these were changes that I was having to make, but especially over the disabled parking space because they didn't have the number that they should have anyway. And then, of course, I'm not the only person there with a disability with, you know, the parking permit. So anybody could have parked there. So it was kind of making arrangements with the neighbors knowing that I need to park there. That is the only way I can get in and out of my car. Please don't take that parking space.
Mm-hmm.
We have run into those.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, in dealing with HOAs, and I've been in cases where defending different people for different reasons concerning those organizations, is that if anyone has a problem with HOAs, people who have any kind of disabilities, there are laws governing that. So HOAs don't have the final word. They have to abide by specific laws which say that they cannot discriminate. And even in there was to be a communal house, and they're known for different names, but if several persons who have different disabilities live in a specifically designed home to take care of what their needs, HOAs cannot actually say no to them.
Right.
And the HUD does have governing rules about that, and in fact, they can actually sue the HOA on behalf of the persons who have disabilities and are being discriminated against. So, you know, those are things that most people don't really know, and they suffer essentially because they didn't know that happened. Also,
that's
the
case in most instances where you
yes.
have to go to a government entity to
exactly.
get relief to have them seek an injunction or some type of relief for you. There is no direct way
right.
to do that on your own. Like my situation with the bus, if that would have happened to me because of my sex or because mm-hmm. of my religion or ethnicity, then it would have been obviously a straight to the court, I'm going to
mm-hmm.
do this thing. And unfortunately, the Americans with Disability Act leaves that out, and it was designed
right.
to leave that out. I mean, it was originally supposed to be a part of civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
George Bush Sr.
Mm-hmm.
tried to veto it. Congress couldn't garner enough support to be able to override that veto, so it became its own kind of standalone law.
Right.
But without those enforcements, and that has really been kind of injurious to people with disabilities, because a lot of times, and you know, I've filed the complaints before. And you
mm-hmm.
almost feel like you need a law degree to do some of this.
Yeah.
And you can't expect the average person to know, like, where to go. And even just before calling in here, I was just kind of doing a search on, like, the various disability laws in various states. And they're very
mm-hmm.
difficult to find. Some states do have, like, 503C groups that are, you know, willing to kind of help people with disabilities to navigate that, but they don't exist in every state, and actually I only found them in like 8 states.
Mm.
So it is something that's very difficult, and I mean, I'm not looking to go sue happy on people.
Sure. Yeah.
A great example of just the effectiveness of this was actually in Wisconsin. They had a law that was passed in 2009. Unfortunately, it's been repealed since. But it was the Equal Pay Enforcement Act that allowed people that were victims of workplace discrimination to seek damages in the state courts. At the time, Wisconsin ranked 36th in the nation for gender pay inequality. A year later, they had climbed up to 24th, but nobody had ever filed a lawsuit under this law. So sometimes just the threat of being able to file a lawsuit is enough to encourage people to make the accommodations that need to be made. And unfortunately,
Faith,
that's not something that is available to people with disabilities.
Faith, if you were to suggest a place for people to go if they need help in this arena, what suggestion would you make?
That's really a difficult one to answer, because I haven't really been very successful at finding people that are that willing to help out. I guess, depending on the state that you're in, you know, a lot of times ACLU will get involved depending on what type of discrimination we're looking at and just what their staff resources are. Really, most of the time, it's government agencies. In the video that I know you're going to post later, I listed all of the members of the House Bipartisan Disability Caucus, because these are the people that, although you're on the Disability Caucus, you should be standing up for people with disabilities. If we are still facing these types of problems 23 years after the ADA passed, then you're not doing your job, and you need to be doing your job. So really, I think the best resource is to just contact your representatives, contact the people that are supposed to be doing these things that aren't doing them, and really letting them know. Because if they're not aware of what's going on and, you know, the kind of challenges people are facing, then obviously they're not going to see a big need for amendments and for new policies and legislation to be passed. So I think really just kind of informing society as a whole, and also our representation, really is kind of a key part of getting some of these things changed.
Well, thank you so much, Faith. We're going to put a link up on the site to your video. Thanks again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, Lisa Vena, our next guest is a journalist, publisher, women's rights activist, Ms. Emine Dilik. Emine, welcome.
Hi, Richard.
How are you tonight, my dear?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. I've also got Luis Cuevas with me as a co-host tonight.
Hi, Luis.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you. Is Faith gone? Because I had a question for her, but I don't know if she's listening.
I'm sorry, she's clicked off, but I'm sure she'll still listen.
No problem. There was just this international, you know, I'm into more international stuff. It was called Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, and it was rejected by our Senate in past December, and it's a very important treaty, and it really enforces the, you know, American laws to change at federal level. which, you know, we don't usually like that in the United States. You know, our federal government doesn't like the international laws to be forced upon us. But it was really wonderful. I know it because through one of my, when I was in the international committee at National Organization for Women, one of our friends, my colleagues, was disabled. She was also, she's also a civil rights attorney, and she was very involved with this. That's why I was going to ask her if they were working on this, but hopefully maybe she'll, you know, answer back or message on that.
Sure. Well, I'll send her your question after the show. So why don't you tell us a little about what's new at Progressive Press?
Progressive Press is doing excellent, actually. We I get the Google Analytics, you know, our tracking system every Friday, the information how we're doing. Last Friday, we hit about 11,000 people, visitors per week. So we are over 43,000 people each month. And this is our third month. So I'm very, very proud of, you know, my colleagues and everyone.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah.
So what stories are you covering right now?
Well, you know, we cover, as you know, we have definitely more of an international, broader message. So we cover international issues as well as what's domestic. But to keep to today's shows, your show's theme, as far as the human rights goes, there were two things that I want to talk about. One is, it's of course very close to my heart as being an immigrant, about the comprehensive immigration reform that is being about. And then the second is about a Syrian refugee who is stuck in Switzerland right now. And let me just mention her, that because we just reported that. It's reported on March 11. We have a correspondent, one of our writers, journalist, Clarissa Frankfurt. She lives in Switzerland. And we didn't know, nobody knew about it, actually. I think maybe we are the only media outlet out there in the United States covered this. This is about a young Syrian woman. She's 26 years old. Her name is Rasha Aldrir, and we have all the information on the site. If anybody would like to just type Syrian refugee, you know, search for it, you'll get to the article. She managed to run away from what's happening in Syria right now, as you're aware of probably, and
sure,
your listeners. 70,000 people have been killed last 2 years because of the civil war. So somehow, some way, she managed to run, you know, free herself through Germany, Italy, and ended up in Switzerland. And what happened there is really, I mean, as big of a shock to our correspondent, who is a citizen of Switzerland, as much as to us, because, you know, European countries, especially, you know, Northern, Eastern, Western, well known for their, you know, stand on human rights. You know, they even have an international human rights court there. So she got jailed in Switzerland. They literally put her in jail. So we don't know the background of it. They just said she didn't have the proper papers. But Clarissa is saying that they could work around it. She has an attorney, I believe. But the last decision on court was they're sending her back basically to Italy. And Clarissa thinks, and a lot of human rights organizations are against it too, because I think Italy doesn't have the greatest, you know, detention areas for refugees. And so she's basically going to be stuck in a refugee detained area for months, and we don't know after that what's going to happen. So I just wanted to mention that, you know, her plight and what's happening. And the second thing is the immigration reform. I had a chance to interview the director of Suentame. This is an organization that has millions of followers and members and about over 100,000 people following them on Facebook. They're basically an activist organization working to bring, you know, awareness about immigrant rights, and their activist writers got together and working on this. And I had a chance to interview their director, Axel Caballero. And the title of my article is called, "Is the New Immigration Reform a Sham?" So if anyone is interested in this, they can read it. Because he explained it to me that, you know, what we understand, supposedly there were these 8 senators bipartisan, right, four from Republicans and four from Democrats got together to create this reform. He is saying that each area, the White House has another law, these bipartisan senators came up with another law, the House itself, the representatives came up there like 9-point reform. So he said that they didn't even, these organizations, immigrant rights organizations, they didn't even see the law yet. So there is no law that's just being talked. So they can't even make the decision on the law. The second thing is, he is saying, Axel was saying, the law, anything that they saw, I think the White House one leaked, they completely missed the point on what is important. They're focusing on enforcement again. They're focusing on rape. They're focusing on, you know, detaining people instead of really getting the families together, instead of focusing on the human rights aspect of the issue. So that's a really wonderful interview. If anyone is interested, if you'd like to learn more about the comprehensive law that's being told and what it's covering, what it's not covering, we have 11 million immigrants, and I think this law is only going to cover about 2 million to get them, you know, path to the citizenship. There, we have over 400,000 immigrants detained in private prisons all over the place, from Arizona, everywhere. And we're paying, you and I, our tax dollars, we're paying about $100 to $200 per night for per immigrant being kept in those area, in those jails. So it's a really good comprehensive interview. I'd like people to take a look at it and read it if they have time.
Well, that's good. I'm looking at your front page right now. My goodness, it's a lot of good stories on there.
Thanks.
I see there's also a story about the mercy ships. Could
you
talk a bit about that?
Yes, I didn't know anything about them. Our wonderful K.L. Johnson, she's from California, and she writes very well. She has a full-time job, but she, you know, volunteers as a writer for us. And she covered this, and, you know, we had a discussion about it. Nobody knew about this. Did you know about them before?
No, I hadn't.
Yeah, I mean, they did a wonderful job, and they've been around since 1978, and there's this big, massive 500 feet long, 16,000 tons, 400 crew members ship floating around in, you know, African coast, providing health care for poor people, health care for people that, you know, don't have access to hospitals or doctors. And it's just awesome. An estimated 1 billion people that had provided health care. So it's a really good story. If anyone, it's a very good, you know, feel-good story to restore your faith in humanity. If you'd like to read it and get involved, it's called Mercy Ships, Nearly 2.5 Million Lives Changed.
Another interesting story, I thought, was the Supreme Court activists. The activist Supreme Court judge creating their own power.
Oh, the recent one from Pat. Yes, that's a Pat also writes for Yahoo. She's very knowledgeable. She has a undergraduate degree on political science. So she's our I call her the information on our laws lady. You know, these are the things that if you just click on her name on the article, you'll see her other articles. She covers most of our, you know, judicial part, constitution. All these things, and it's a really, really good article, again, to get a lot of information. Most of it is based on research, you know, laws. So they are usually a little bit heavier, so they're my Sunday morning articles. So we publish them Sunday morning. You don't want to read them at night. Have your cup of coffee and learn about our, you know, courts and laws and how it works. It's pretty, you know, good information, a lot of good information on it.
Well, you know, you mentioned that immigration story, and I don't think we can let that go by. Did you hear last weekend Jeb Bush was touring the talk shows talking about his new book? And in his immigration reform scheme, he had found no road to citizenship. But then when pressed, decided that maybe there was a road to citizenship. Did you see that flip-flop? Did you catch any of that story?
No, actually, I didn't, because I was just too busy focusing on solutions, I guess, and read him. I think when I hear the name Bush, I have this kind of immediate reaction to it, to not, like, at first not get too much involved. I think maybe I'm going to start listening to him if he officially says he's a presidential candidate for,
no,
you know.
No, he's weaseling around on that.
Seriously, I have, I think, some kind of allergy to the name now. When I hear the name Bush, I kind of daze it over. I don't know what happens. But well, the path to citizenship, what Axel was telling me, even for the leaked reform from the White House, they don't cover a lot of people. I mean, you have to be, first of all, it says there is a dream component to it, like you have to have a minimum high school degree, and then you have to, quote-unquote, is that in good moral character? So, for example, it's 400,000 people that are stuck in jail just because they don't have their paperwork, not because they're criminals, they just did not have their paperwork. And they're not going to be eligible. They're not going to be eligible for it. They're going to be either sent back and or, you know, stay there for us to basically, you know, line up the pockets of the CEOs of these private prisons. So it's a huge issue. I think it affects everyone, even people that are not involved with immigration. We need to understand what's going on. And then really come, he was saying that the anti-immigrant groups, basically, they're so loud, they have been so loud, even though they're a smaller section of our population, because they've been so loud, and because some of the news outlets like Fox have been giving them a platform to say their, you know, hateful rhetoric, we have turned this idea of immigration in our minds for them being just criminals. You know, just every immigrant is a criminal. So, you know, there are a lot of work that we need to. There is a lot of work we need to work around to change that image. And, you know, organizations like this one, Suentame, I really like them a lot. If you'd like to visit their Facebook page, it's C-U-E-N-T-A-M-E, and you can read my article on that to learn more about what's going on.
I noticed you also cover a story on the HSBC settlement.
Yes.
We found that quite interesting and played a couple of those Elizabeth Warren quotes on that last week.
Yes, I know. Elizabeth Warren, we love her. I'm hoping one day we'll get an interview, but she's probably just too busy getting things done then. I mean, she's one of the few people that we really have a lot of respect in Congress, you know. Just as our trust in Congress was falling apart, there comes this person. She's awesome. I mean, she, that thought about, you know, if you get caught with an ounce of cocaine, that you're going to jail, but evidently if you launder billions of dollars, just a slap on the wrist, they'll just let you go. And that's, you know, that's, I don't know how to react to this sometimes. I mean, these are the things that make, I think, people hate the system and hate the government and become anarchists, especially young people. Seriously, you're thinking, I mean, there are fundamental problems in the system that has to be changed, and this is one of them. I mean, we have to start putting these people in jail. That's it. I mean, it's not just civil punishment. You know, they can't just get away. And the amount that they're being charged, it's like saying someone robbed a bank and got $150,000 and then a $5 fee to let him out. Do you know what I'm trying to say? The amount
absolutely.
That's being laundered, and the amount of the fee that's being charged to them as a punishment, it's just a joke. It's ridiculous. So that's, I think, very frustrating, and it's making you really lose faith in, you know, laws. But we're trying. Everyone is trying. It's one of our jobs as, you know, news people to bring this information out so people see. And, you know, and we also have people like Elizabeth Warren, our senators now, Bernie Sanders, you know, Mr. Grayson, that we think they're pushing for better reforms. Hopefully we'll see some good change.
You know, I think to me the most troubling aspect of it, rather than, you know, focusing on the trading with terrorists or the money laundering, the thing that to me strikes at the very heart of our judicial system is that there's supposed to be one law for everyone, rich and poor alike. There is one law, and that has been a foundation of laws in the West since the Magna Carta, since the Great Charter. That's one of the things that was insisted upon by the nobles of King John. And unfortunately, the problem is that this flies completely in the face of that, that this makes a lie of that. And when we have the Attorney General come out and say, well, you know, they're just too big to prosecute, there might be other impacts. Well, at what point, and as Elizabeth Warren is so incredibly capable of drawing with a simple analogy your attention to the absolute absurdity of it. I couldn't agree with you more. She did just a marvelous comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, she's a smart lady, and it's too big to fail and too big to prosecute, too big to jail. This is what happened in, you know, in Great Depression. And right after that, we were able to actually separate, you know, investment banking from consumer banking. All those were separated. So our economy got repaired, basically. And we can definitely do it. It's just the laws are being watered down. You know, the new laws that the President Obama was trying to pass through, that was just, it just didn't work out. It didn't get enforced. So that has to be stronger laws that are keeping these people accountable, and if needed, put them in jail. I understand it's a civil issue, but it is still criminal. Put them in jail. And, you know, people lost their retirements, people lost their pensions. There is a criminal part of it. It's not just, you know, you're lying and people losing money. You know, I was just reading, I did this report on Greece. We had an exclusive YouTube video from someone from Greece, an economist actually. He sent it to us. And it is so bad over there that all those retirees, elder people now lost all their retirement money and they're committing suicide. Their suicide rates are so high. I mean, we don't want to go there. It's just heartbreaking. So we need to come up with better laws. We need to come up with accountability. Definitely start persecuting these people.
You know, we've been talking about your wonderful new website and the great work that you're doing there, and we haven't mentioned the web address. Please correct that, Emily. Tell our audience what the name of your website is and where they can go to find it.
Sure. It's progressivepress.net, progressivepress.net. And we also have a Twitter, twitter.com. It's progressivepress. I couldn't get the whole name there, so it's Progressive PRS. I know Twitter is all over the place, but you can absolutely follow us there. And we upload all our articles there, daily articles, and our separate videos as well. So you can follow us through Twitter. Or we also are on Facebook. You can just type Progressive Press. You'll see our nice big, I call it star logo. So you can find us on Facebook. Also, progressivepress.net is our website.
Let me ask you this. How often is your website refreshed? New content?
We try to cover, right now, because we only have about 20 writers and everything is volunteer-based, so we all have full-time jobs, so we're trying to cover the major stories, like the you know, Supreme Court issues, or just like that Cyprus bailout. We usually get 2 to 3 main articles a day.
Wow.
And then plus our you know, cartoons and, you know, other videos. And then Facebook, if you go to Facebook, if we can't cover more local issues, like the statewide issue, like that rape happened, 16-year-old girl was raped, and then the two boys were convicted today.
Yeah.
That one we didn't have a chance to cover, but we have extensive coverage of that on our Facebook page. So what we can't cover when we don't have time or the, you know, ability to do it, we cover it on our Facebook page. So basically, if you follow our Facebook page, you'll get all the news, breaking news, and also our, you know, through our international news through our website too.
Well, that's fantastic. Luis, do you have any questions you might want to raise with M&A?
Well, actually, we are looking at your Twitter page right now, and Progressive Push is going to be following you.
Okay.
And we will definitely put the word out to other folks. One of the interesting things that I have found that is very distressing is that the whole issue, we're constantly banging on this. We should not be talking about illegal aliens because nobody is illegal to start with. We're talking about people who are undocumented. The other one issue is that when we throw all these numbers in terms of 12 million undocumented people in the United States, well, actually, nobody knows where that number comes from. There is no actual basis from it, and we have research even in the state of Florida from the census, and it will tell you that there are from maybe 300,000 to possibly 3 million. Well, if you were to do a problem in arithmetic and you have such a wide angle, you know, that wouldn't go. But essentially, it's coming to this, that, and you mentioned it earlier, that's why I bring it up, is the private prison corporations that are making huge amounts of money on this. And the United States, the federal government, is actually paying these prisons $162 per head per day.
Yeah, it's a $5 billion industry.
Yes.
And I really urge everyone to really read. If you don't like to read, I know it's a long interview, just watch the videos. This video that they came up with, sometime in May, they make up videos. It's called Immigrants for Sale. I urge everyone to watch that. I mean, it's going to just, you know, send chills down to your spine that how these people are treated. And people, I really don't like the rhetoric about it, too, the way the wordage is used. They say, oh, but if you're going through the border, you're breaking the law. First of all, these people don't know if they're breaking the law because they don't know the United States laws. They just, most of them, and I asked Alex, I said, Axel, do you know what's the percentage of people that are coming through the border are actual criminals? He said probably 5 to 10%, which is, you know, a general population. And but here we are because of this anti-immigrant organizations being so loud and so out there and very well funded, by the way. They have a lot of money. They're well organized. Portraying all immigrants as if criminal people. I'm an immigrant. You know, you can say I have this accent. And people see me. It was so interesting. You know, they see me like, oh, we didn't think, you know, you don't look like an immigrant. You know, you have this blonde hair. Like, what is that? What does that mean? I don't know what that means. So we're focused on human rights part of this. There are a lot of families being separated.
Mm-hmm.
There are 5,000 children of immigrants live in U.S. foster cares right now. And if the current trends hold, it says it's estimated about 15,000 more children over the next 5 years will be ripped away from their parents because most of them are born here and they became citizens and then they send the other siblings and the parents deport them. So we have to find out something in between. You know, I can understand people's apprehensive about security, border security. I do understand that. But we have to find a way to focus more on the human side of the issue, human rights issue.
Right.
And because the borders are, I mean, what Axel was telling me, it's safe. We have really strong borders. We have drones right now over the border. So they're very secure.
You know we've been studying this and going to the different attorneys, immigration attorneys, regarding this issue, and the most blatant violation of immigration law right now, which makes you a criminal automatically by the standards of certain conservative individuals in this country, is that you overstay your visa by one day. If you do that, you're automatically outside of the law. It's just, and they use that in the numbers.
And actually, as someone who has been through the immigration system in this country, let me tell you something. It's usually out of your own hand if you're staying, you know, one day extra without your visa, because the system of getting your proper paperwork back and forth is so clogged and that I remember when I was getting my green card, I almost fell, you know, undocumented, because I sent my application and they told me it was going to be get back to me in like a few months, and then the months passed and months passed. It was almost like 10 days before the expiration of my visa, I got it back. So it's like it's sometimes not at your hands either. You just are out of it because the immigration maybe don't have, they're short staff, I don't know, you know, underfunded probably, so they can't really keep up with the demand either. And another thing, the attorneys, a lot of people don't know, even when you're trying to do the right thing as an immigrant, which I did, I hired an attorney, my first attorney. He took, meanwhile, I was working $5 an hour, by the way. He took $3,000 of my money, and he did nothing. He just left, and never find him. So there are these things that a lot of people don't understand how the system works, and they're thinking everyone just, you know, being, you know, want to come into the United States and be criminals, and that's really not the case. Even when you're trying to do the right thing, the actual road to the proper legal immigration is so broken. The system itself is so broken, so expensive, and so cumbersome that it's very, very difficult for any person to, you know, get through.
Exactly. If I might, I have a little anecdote that what happened to me. I am originally from Puerto Rico. We're born U.S. citizens. We all have accents, you see, you know. And I was thrown in the back of a police car because this individual, you know, stopped me, and my accent, you know, gave me away. I don't know. And he wanted to know, you know, call immediately to have a checkup on me. And, I mean, it was amazing. You know, I had my wallet with me, so I could produce a license that they could look into. But if God forbid, an individual, man or woman, leaves their wallet behind and no ID, they get in tremendous trouble. And I know people who have actually been kept for a day or two in jail until they could proceed to process, you know, the paperwork and find out. And these are American citizens. I know of a case of an individual who actually was in Puerto Rico. A Puerto Rican is traveling towards the United States by, you know, by plane. He's stopped by immigration. They ask him about his papers and say, I am Puerto Rican. I don't have any papers. I don't need any papers. And they said, no, you look Colombian. The poor fellow says, no, I'm not from Colombia. I'm from Puerto Rico. No, you look Colombian. Sorry. Well, they actually packed him up in an airplane, sent him over to Colombia. When he got to Colombia, of course, the authority says, where's your papers? You don't have any papers. And they said, I'm an American citizen. I'm from Puerto Rico. And they said, so they sent him in a plane to New York City. He managed somehow to get a hold of family, told them, you know, what had happened. He gets rescued, and then he gets a bill from the Federal Immigration Department for a trip to Colombia and a trip to New York.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much. Go ahead.
I was just saying that the system itself is just so broken, you know, it needs to be repaired, and then it's not going to happen by just pandering to extremists and immigrant groups. They need to really focus on the Latino community and other, you know, immigrant communities and get the people there and work with them.
Well, you know, we've got at least three or four different views from the Republican Party, and hopefully they'll actually do something that makes sense. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And congratulations again on progressivepress.net, and we'll be watching. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, have a good night.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to bring on Miss Professor Summer Gentry. who is going to talk about the latest twist and turn of the TSA. Welcome, Professor.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me again.
Oh, it's our pleasure. It's always great to hear the intelligent views of a very critical issue. Thank you. What's new? What's your opinion on this latest? Hey, they can bring knives and sticks on.
Well, actually, I think this is a smart move. I think that these items are completely innocuous and never were a threat to the aircraft. The sporting equipment that they're allowing, lacrosse sticks and novelty baseball bats, it's just completely implausible that anyone would think that an item like this is going to be used to injure someone or take over a plane. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you are carrying around the mall with you, or you know, you have your little Swiss Army knife for cutting up an apple or something. But what's amazing is really the reaction to it. The TSA does something completely sensible and removes a restriction on an item that's really not a credible threat to the aircraft, and the world goes crazy. You know, the flight attendants are saying, oh, there's going to be blood running in the aisles, you know, someone's going to attack me with a lacrosse stick. It just shows how hysterical the American public has become. But, you know, I have to say that TSA made its own bed on this one. They're the ones who told us to fear these everyday objects in the first place.
I was just surprised they didn't mention tweezers and nail files, you know.
Well, tweezers and nail files have been permitted for a long time. There was a similar rollback at a different point when they started allowing scissors and lighters and other kinds of objects. I don't remember seeing the same kind of hysteria around that, those decisions, but the reality is that these kinds of things fly all the time. The TSA does not do a good job of keeping its own banned items list off of airplanes. I mean, we see it in the news probably weekly that someone's brought a loaded gun. There was the man in who brought a stun gun through JFK last week.
Oh, my goodness.
After allegedly raping his girlfriend. And, you know, we have the 12-inch razor blades that were carried on the plane. The businessman who reported that he had a loaded gun on an airplane. The TSA is not effective at keeping its list of banned items off airplanes anyway. So that should really give people a lot of peace about this, because these items fly all the time. I mean,
it's a reasonable step for them to reduce
this banned items list.
Well, you're absolutely right. A turn to the sensible. Maybe it's just that a turn to the sensible is what's shocking people.
Perhaps, but I think it's a little bit more than that. You know, the comment I read most often on this change was, wait, I can bring a knife, but I can't bring shampoo. Right? It seems like the TSA is just doing another one of its typically tone-deaf responses. If they wanted to have a positive public response to a change that they could make, they should start allowing liquids back on the airplane. And in fact, the TSA already has the technology to allow any size liquids onto the airplane. They have these devices called bottled liquid scanners. And so if you have a liquid in a sealed container, if it were a dangerous liquid, it would be giving off these particular vapors that are detectable. So all you need to do is unscrew the top and test to see whether these particular vapors are coming off. And if they're not, well, then it's safe shampoo and it can fly. The only reason the TSA hasn't implemented these is that they claim that would slow down the scanning lines, perhaps. Or maybe they don't have the funds to buy these bottled liquid scanners, but, you know, they've already wasted $40 million on backscatter scanners that they're now having to backpedal and take them out of the airports because people were unwilling to accept the nude images they created.
Has there been any improvement that you've heard of on the no-fly list?
The no-fly list is a separate issue. Please bring that back to me again. I just wanted to finish my point about the TSA's lack of interest in what the public wants from screening. I think it's really amazing that they would go after these short knife restrictions and yet not be working on lifting the restriction on liquids. It just shows that the TSA really doesn't care what the public thinks of what it's doing. And I think that that's what's gotten it in trouble as an organization over and over again. So if they're lifting the restriction on knives and if they're suddenly getting pushback from the flight attendants unions and from the airlines and from a few congressmen, actually, who've said, oh, this is a terrible decision. How dare they allow knives on the plane? Even though these, we're talking about tiny little Swiss Army knives, not threatening, scary knives. It just shows that the TSA isn't really in touch with what changes the public is demanding in airport security. You know, in fact, they really don't care how angry we are. And
yeah, that's
I think,
that's evident, yeah. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I feel bad for the TSA in a way that they make a perfectly sensible change and people freak out.
Uh-huh.
But then in another way, they sort of brought this on themselves by ignoring the public's actual concerns about airport screening.
Sure, sure. Well, they've been practicing being tone deaf for so long, I guess it's hard for them to change. as soon as they can figure out a way to get money from doing other sensible things, maybe they'll do that too.
And as far as the no-fly list, I haven't heard there's been too much progress, although the courts have allowed one challenge to the no-fly list to continue. This was challenged by a woman who was a student at Stanford University. She's a citizen of, I forget what country, she's not a U.S. citizen. And
right.
She left the country voluntarily, and the U.S. won't allow her to fly back. So she's challenging her placement on that no-fly list because she has ongoing projects at Stanford University she should be coming back to work on. They won't let her fly. She's not banned from the country. So at first they were successful in trying to keep her challenge out of court, but those decisions have been overturned, and so she will be allowed to challenge the no-fly list, and I think the ACLU is involved with that case.
Okay, excellent. Any other TSA news we should know about?
Quite a lot, actually. You might recall that EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center,
right,
won a lawsuit against the TSA, and in July of 2011, the TSA was ordered to conduct a public notice and comment period about the body scanners, about their body scanner program. The TSA stonewalled this for 20 months, and EPIC went back to the original court and said that the TSA should really be forced to conduct this public notice and comment period. And the TSA said, oh, well, we're not delaying it at all. We had some staffing issues. But they promised the court that the public notice and comment period would be conducted by February 2013. Well, so here we are in March 2013, no public notice and comment period in the Federal Register. So the TSA has once again thumbed its nose at the court and said, we will do what we like. You know, Administrative Procedures Act requirements be damned. Just amazing.
I see on the TSA page they have an always available public outreach department. And I'm sure that that's something that we would all find very informative. And here I see they have a TSA civil rights posting. Let's see what this has to say. TSA is dedicated to keeping the nation's transportation system safe and secure for traveling public. TSA cannot succeed without its professional, highly talented, fully engaged, respected workforce. Let's see. To achieve and maintain this diverse workforce, we will do the following. Fully comply with all applicable federal laws and presidential executive orders. Enforce a zero-tolerance policy for any form of harassment in the workplace. Review and analyze with the public civil rights and civil liberties considered how our policies and operations impact the programs and services. Assure that no one shall be subject to retaliation for opposing unlawful discrimination, and provide training on EEO laws and the value of diversity and diversity management. The TSA's responsibilities are important, but I think for too long, whether it be under the color of a security awareness level, is today's security orange or yellow? I forget. While it is an important thing, unfortunately, some of this overreach, I think, has really completely given them a very bad position in the public mind. And as you say, here they made an intelligent decision, and yet it's not being perceived correctly. It's not being received accurately.
Absolutely, and I think you're right that these issues are all bound up together because the TSA has been seen repeatedly to be incompetent and to discriminate against people that it should really be taking care of, you know, the disabled, the sick. One group that's been particularly disadvantaged by the TSA's, you know, completely ludicrous choice of body scanners as a security method is the transgender LGBTQ community, because some people who are, I guess, gender ambiguous, this was a front page article in the Huffington Post, a woman who says that sometimes people have difficulty discriminating her gender. She says she went through a body scanner, and then a woman asked her at full volume in front of the whole airport, "Are you a woman or a man?" And she titled her article, "Why I Hate the TSA." And because what happened to her was she got in the body scanner, the screener pushed a button apparently to guess whether the person in the scanner is a man or a woman, guessed wrong. And the body scanner flagged this traveler as, you know, she has the wrong body. And I think that we're tied up in notions of our body image. And when you get in a machine and the machine says there's something wrong with your body, I think that's not okay. And it's actually not relevant to security whether someone is a man or a woman. Really, men and women are both allowed to fly. Why should this machine say your body's wrong? The problem with these scanners is they're finding lots and lots of completely innocuous information about travelers' bodies and then singling those people out for mistreatment at the hands of security. People who get flagged because they've had mastectomies. People who get flagged because they have ambiguous genitalia, they're, you know, in the midst of transitioning genders, or because they have a medical problem, they have an implanted medical device. None of these things are relevant to security. And yet anyone with any of these conditions is guaranteed to be flagged as abnormal, wrong, and picked out by the TSA. I mean, and this is the problem, because the body scanners are not detecting explosives, they're not detecting dangerous materials, they're judging your body.
Amazing. I have a co-host tonight, Luis Cuevas, so Progressive Push. Luis, do you have any questions you would like to ask of our guest, Ms. Professor Gentry?
Yeah, one of the two things. One is, as a way of a comment, is that when they are using these scanners and all these computers, you know, they're only as smart as the questions and whatever data you put in them. So obviously, somebody is not waking up and smelling the coffee in the morning, you know, when they deal with programming these apparatus. The other one thing is that, and I've been there too, when, you know, traveling to pick up my mother and bring her to live with me in Florida. It was a one-way ticket. She was on a wheelchair, and this person looks at us, everything is fine, then suddenly said, "Oh, you have one-way ticket." And we had to go through the incredible checks in security just because my mother is there, and she's 82 years old. She's suffering from dementia, and they put her through this whole thing. About checking up with, nobody had the brains, you know, to go about, you know, come on, you know, wait a minute, what threat is this? If you had your chance at telling the security administration to do one big change, what would that be?
Well, honestly, I really think that they should eliminate pat-downs entirely.
Mm.
But actually, when I think about it, perhaps what the change is that they need to make is they need to be transparent about what their success rates are with all of these different technologies. They have treated their test results as a state secret, and yet that leaves us unable to make decisions about prioritizing how to spend our limited resources. Would it be worth it to spend all this time giving everyone a manual pat-down? Should we have more body scanners? Should we have more bottled liquid scanners? Well, the TSA won't tell us whether these technologies are effective at finding threats. And I think that the problem is if we knew how ineffective all of these technologies really are, we would say none of it is worth doing. I think that they, you know, it's a technique called security by obscurity. If you pretend that no one can find out your methods don't work, then you never have to design methods that do work.
Do you think that there might be in college we used to call the bureaucratic imperative, that you somehow have to make your job, rationalize the need for your job? And plus the fact that some of these services are hired out to private contractors.
Well, I think.
Go ahead.
Yes, at heart, this is all about the money. This is an industry, and there are people raking in their living based on creating a false fear of novelty baseball bats and someone's blow-up toy hammer. It's absurd, but they're making their living off of it.
So
there's the motive to pretend that all of these items are extremely threatening when they're not.
Mm.
And you can see that the public has bought into that message. Oh, you should be terrified of a 2-inch knife. Really? But beyond that, I think in a way the TSA is failing to achieve its bureaucratic imperative to preserve itself, because they've made so many terrible decisions that really cost it in terms of public image. And I think there's a lot less support for the TSA's mission now, as we see them fail, as we see them fail to find the explosives at Newark last week, as we see them mistreat a 3-year-old girl with spina bifida in a wheelchair, as we see, you know, videos of them putting their hands down the pants of a 6-year-old girl. These things do not make us want to fund the TSA at higher levels, I think. I really can't explain how they have been so incompetent, because it doesn't even seem to serve their own purposes of generating more support for their mission. I'm still imagining the conference table where everyone sat around and said, I'll bet parents will let us take naked pictures of their children. I mean, who thought that that was a good idea?
Well, it's such an unfortunate turn that these systems have taken. And, you know, being a person that's civil liberties oriented myself, I hate to see any intrusion in the privacy of a person. And when they've made such a mistake, such a botch of the whole system, it can't help but turn the public's mind away from any legitimate work that they might take, or any legitimate interest that they might have in trying to protect us, because they've clearly just done a terrible, terrible job. I know your website monitors these issues. Have there been any reports lately on your site?
Yes, you know, there was the 3-year-old girl in the wheelchair. So her parents did not want to allow the TSA to pat her down because she's medically fragile. And the sort of ham-handed way that the screener demanded to touch, you know, a medically fragile 3-year-old girl wouldn't allow her parents to intervene. And then the screener also informed the parents that filming was illegal. It is not. The TSA does not ban filming or pictures of pat-downs or of any of their security procedures. And so really the screeners are just making rules up. Whatever seems convenient to them at the time, they will tell the public, even when it's wrong. But I do think that parents need to be aware that these kinds of things happen and that documenting their experiences is actually a powerful weapon, because it was when the cameras came out that the tone of the screening changed, and they went to get a supervisor and they said, wait, do we really have to pat this girl down? And in the end, they did not give the three-year-old a pat down.
Well, Professor Gentry, could you please give our audience the website so they can find out more information about the TSA's excesses?
Absolutely. We're writing basically every day at the TSA News Blog, tsanewsblog.com.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We sure appreciate it. I hope you'll come back again.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Professor Gentry of the U.S. Naval College, mathematics professor, physics professor. And our next guest is a regional journalist, an award-winning journalist from Scripps, a woman named Eve Samples. And I recorded this interview just a few days ago. So, Luis, sit back. This is going to be a good one. And,
all right.
Be back with you in just a little while. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Eve Samples of Scripps.
Fantastic.
Hello, Ms. Samples. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me. How are you today?
Very good, thank you. And yourself?
Doing well. I'm in the middle of the newsroom, so forgive any background noise, please.
Oh, that's okay. I can forgive almost anything from a newsroom. As long as they deliver the truth, and that's what's important. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
We aim for it.
Always an important target, that's for sure. Well, the first thing I want to ask you is, I always ask my activist guests, what was it that made them step up to the plate when life is complicated enough, trying to make a living, trying to have a roof, maybe trying to have a family and friends? So let me ask you the same thing. What was it that led you to journalism?
Sure. And journalism and activism aren't necessarily the same thing, but
right.
Since I'm a columnist and express my opinion in the paper, I guess there are some similarities in my case. But I have been in the business about 13 years. I've spent a decade as a reporter first before I became a columnist, and I covered everything from local government to business. I did a little bit of cops reporting when I first got into the business. And when this opportunity came up a few years ago to do some local column writing for Scripps Treasure Coast newspapers, I welcomed it. It was a chance to choose what I wrote about, to interject my opinion a little more. And I have to admit, after a decade of being careful to keep my opinion out of the news, which, is we try our best, but everyone comes with their own perspective. But putting it in a bolder way felt a little bit unfamiliar, but kind of hit my stride now and honed in on some topics that interest me, and I'm really enjoying it.
Well, that's great. Did you write when you were young?
I grew up in a newspaper family. My father and mother actually worked for newspapers when I was growing up. My dad was a copy editor for a number of years. He used to copy edit my letters home from camp, actually. And always a lot of stories around the dinner table about what was going on in the news. And you would have thought that I'd steer away from the business, because I'll never forget the day when I was in grade school. My dad came home and had lost his job, because the Miami News, which was the afternoon paper at the time in Miami, had gone under.
I remember it well.
It was a time when a lot of afternoon papers around the country were folding. Kind of a foreshadowing the other troubles that would come to newspapers after I got into the business. It's been an interesting ride as we've tried to juggle the digital world with the print world.
It always struck me odd that the afternoon papers would be the first to go, because it seems that that would be where the day was summed up. And
for me, I still read, if I get the Sunday New York Times, I'm still reading it in the evening, and it's kind of my time to relax. But I think the deadline pressure of getting the news out as quickly as possible is the reason that you saw the afternoon papers go first. And now, of course, we're in this purported 24-hour news cycle, although I think on the network cable news channels, you see them repeat a lot of the same news over and over. So
that is remarkably noticeable, yeah. You know, I think we'll really honestly be able to declare an end to the illusion of a 24/7 news cycle when those important government agencies stop releasing news at 6 o'clock on Friday afternoon.
Right. Oh, and that still happens inevitably. It's also a very popular time for filing controversial lawsuits, you know, from 4:59 right before the courthouse closes.
So you were in Miami and your father was in Miami. Let's see, the news, what was it, closed in the 80s, was it?
Or yes, late 70s? It was the 80s. Oh, I guess. I can't remember the exact year off the top of my head. It was the 80s, though, and he ended up getting lucky. He found a job at the Herald. The Herald hired a lot of old news expatriates. He was a copy editor at the Herald, where he retired. And the Herald has faced its struggles as well. I mean, it's part of the reason I'm working at a community newspaper now. Some of the larger and mid-sized metropolitan dailies have faced some bigger challenges here on the Treasure Coast where we are. We still have a lot of more dedicated print readers. But, of course, you know, things are always changing.
That's for sure. You know, I always also ask my guests, what is it that you're working on now? I know you're a practicing journalist right now, and you have a range of beats. What stories are you following right now?
Sure. Something that I've written frequently about lately is state incentives for companies, taxpayer-funded incentives for businesses, and this is a pretty hot topic in Tallahassee right now. We're seeing a number of bills emerge on that front that would either require more transparency. In Enterprise Florida, the public-private partnership that funnels incentives to companies around the state is facing increased scrutiny, and there's some talk about whether we even need Enterprise Florida anymore. You know, they call it a public-private partnership, but it's really still reliant on a lot more public money, our money, than private money, and taxpayer incentives are going to companies, in some cases, that have gone belly up. We saw that with Digital Domain here on the Treasure Coast, and they've become kind of the poster child for incentives gone bad.
Yeah, I watched that thing go sour. I've been in the online media business for quite some time, and when I saw them saying, oh, we're opening up studios here, and we're opening up studios there, and we're opening up studios here, and every time I heard that, I'd hear that the county money is involved here, the state money is involved there. It struck me right away that this was a company that was farming grants, and I was not surprised at all to see them go sour. I know what the economic life of a digital company is like, having run one of my own for 20 plus years. And when I see studios opening up in multiple places, in Florida especially, where the home of fraud. It struck me that I'd like to make sure that there's something that actually happens here besides the expectations of lots and lots and lots of well-paying jobs. So I wasn't really surprised. And now we're facing the refuse that's left over.
Yeah, it's been unfortunate. I mean, it was $135 million between state and local incentives for Digital Domain, and we're left with a big empty building in Port St. Lucie right now that the city's trying to rent out, and it's very custom made for this, you know, what was supposed to be a movie making studio. And last I heard, all they'd managed to do with it is rent it out on Sunday mornings to a local church. So you can imagine how much revenue that's bringing in.
Oh, I bet it's a real money maker.
It's not working. Yeah, and I can see a much better argument for taxpayer incentives for some of the biotech companies that have come in. I mean, if we're going to have incentives, I feel better about giving them to companies that are looking for a cure for AIDS, for example, as the Vaccine and Gene Therapy Institute is in Port St. Lucie. It was a tougher sell for a movie-making digital effects company. And also with the biotech companies, there was Jeb Bush, for better or worse, started it as an initiative to jumpstart a new industry for Florida, getting us away from construction and tourism. And the question is, once you've jumpstarted an industry like that, and I think you could argue that's been done in Florida, when do you back off? When do you stop pumping taxpayer money into it?
And when you say Rick Scott and money, there's always an interesting story to be told. I noticed recently we lost our lieutenant governor due to some interesting investments on the part of an internet gambling company. Is that part of your beat?
You know, I've just been watching that story. I haven't written on it, but I've been watching it with interest because Allied Veterans, which is the company at the heart of this case, was on the radar screen of one of my colleagues for years. His name's Joe Crankshaw. He's a veteran himself, and he did a project for us a few years ago revealing the percentage of money that actually gets to veterans from some of these veterans' charities, and Allied Veterans was one of the worst. And, of course, they got very defensive about his reporting at the time, but, you know, lo and behold, a couple of years later now, this company has taken down a lieutenant governor as well. Although I don't know that Florida will be too much worse off without a lieutenant governor. I mean, it's a kind of a ribbon-cutting job, really.
Yeah, yeah. I also wanted to mention that some of the unique challenges that we face in Florida, we've got a very strong, one might even say, a Tea Party-oriented legislature who keeps trying to steer the straight completely rightward, despite the fact that the voting populace doesn't seem to embrace its ideas so much. Are you involved in any stories in the legislature right now?
I keep track or try to keep track of what our local folks are doing. So probably the most powerful local lawmaker up in Tallahassee is Joe Negron. He's heading the Senate Appropriations Committee right now, has a huge role in the state budget, and he's a self-proclaimed libertarian, which means sometimes I really disagree with him, and sometimes every now and then we'll find an issue that we do agree on. Are you thinking
drones by any chance?
What's that?
Are you thinking drones by any chance?
Am I thinking drones? Yeah, I mean, I don't mind the stance he's taken on drones. I don't think anyone likes drones, and that was an interesting spectacle to watch in Washington over the past week. We saw some alliance across the aisle on that one, amazing, in Congress. So, sure, that's one that I think people of all stripes can get on board with, and Negron has taken a stance against drones. But also, he's done some stuff on the right to speak at meetings. Negron has that I agree with. It's more I'm watching with interest his role in ending Medicaid as we know it in the state. I am a little nervous about the privatization of Medicaid in Florida, and also the reluctance to embrace the expansion of Medicaid that would come with the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, the question is what alternative are they going to embrace, because something needs to happen.
Well, I think we've gotten a clear sense of where our legislature would like to take us. If the Republican majority has their ways, that just as soon everything was voucherized and we sold off any of the state properties to the cronies. I mean, excuse me, important business interests. You know, I can't help but see parallels between so much of what happened when the Soviet Union collapsed and all the state resources there were sold off to a privileged few. And this drive to privatize the prisons, the prison health care, the schools, I mean, it's a really interesting paradigm that this legislation agenda coming from ALEC seems to have captured so much of the Republican agenda.
Yeah, I mean, ALEC, you mentioned ALEC, they also, yeah, their model legislation has been embraced a lot in Florida. And I, in some cases, you know, I'm a semi-moderate, I describe myself as. In some cases, I can see it.
You're moderate.
The free, yeah, I can see how the free market would play a beneficial role. Prisons is not one of them. I do not see why there should be a profit motive in holding people in prisons across our country. It's not worked in Texas. It's a major problem. I don't see why we're still talking about that in Florida.
Well, Ms. Samples, we're number one in prisons. We have more people incarcerated than anybody else in the world.
Yeah,
evidently, we do this very well.
And actually, along those lines, something I'm starting to look into right now is a bill that Joe Negron filed related to speeding up the death penalty process in Florida. Speeding up the death penalty process also makes me a little nervous. I have a friend, close friend, who works on death penalty cases, and she has studied the fact that time is, the more time you allow, the greater the chances of uncovering a false conviction.
Sure. And it seems that there's a rush also to speed up foreclosures. They're just not happening fast enough.
Yeah, that's another one I've got on my plate right now. And a lot of the settlement money with the big banks that were involved in the robo-calling is not making it to people who really want to stay in their homes. I just, whenever I met with a couple recently who I'm going to write about, who really wanted to stay in their home in Stewart and just could not work out a loan modification with their bank. Their bank was one of the ones that agreed, you know, was party to the settlement. So they're moving to North Carolina and doing a short sale. And I just don't see who benefits from that. Drags down property values for the neighbors. The bank doesn't even get more money out of it. And their credit is further damaged.
Well, that's okay. We can just bail them out again. Not a problem.
I don't see this working. Actually, I think Pam Bondi, the state attorney general, is having a press conference on this issue this afternoon because she's getting increasing criticism about how the settlement has been executed.
I had some foreclosure experts on last week, people who are fighting in the courts for people who are under foreclosure threat.
Mm-hmm.
And they were telling me that even in cases where the documents were shown to be robo-signed, and the collection agency has said, yes, these are not valid documents. The people sitting in as judges, because they're not actually sitting judges, they're people brought back from retirement, are still awarding it because they said, well, you know, I've got a standing order to sell this. It doesn't matter if the documents were bogus or not. It seems to undercut the whole legitimate legal process. If you don't have a clear title, how can you claim a property? But that seems to be no problem. And, of course, if we're going to speed up the process, that certainly isn't going to allow for more time to correct these kind of problems. You're right. It does seem odd. Who benefits from this? Qui bono, the old famous question. Who benefits from this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Florida has so many interesting challenges from a population that is very economically skewed. We've got a small group of very well-to-do folks, especially in our area, and then you've got the rest of the people who are working for a living and obviously having a quite difficult time of it. Where is Florida going? Where is Florida being taken? What do you see? What guiding forces do you see taking Florida into the next decade?
One of the big ones is water supply. You know, we've seen Governor Scott embrace Everglades restoration, which is quite an about face compared with what he campaigned on when he was elected. But the reason for that is not that he, you know, suddenly wants to go, you know, embrace the natural beauty of the Everglades. He's starting to see it as a water supply issue for the population. So I think addressing that is a big factor. Now, of course, we've got some bills in the legislature now that threaten the ability for local governments to purchase land, and Everglades restoration, make no mistake, involves a lot of land buying. There's a bill out there right now that would force local governments to sell off an equal amount of land that they hold if they purchase new land. So I don't see how that benefits the process. And, you know, we're going to enter the era of some water wars in South Florida if we don't start getting proactive about it. So that's a very basic issue that needs to be addressed.
Well, I see that back in January 26th of this year, Governor Scott and Ms. Bondi agreed to extend leases to Big Sugar for another 30 years on 13,000 acres of state-owned land, which sort of flies in the face of Everglades restoration. But, you know, when Big Sugar knocks, our governor is very attentive to that ear, that's for sure. You know, it seems odd to me, and I think you raise a good point about water. When I relocated up to this part of the coast from further south, and like so many, and mm-hmm. when I first arrived up here, I attended a town hall meeting in the Hobe Sound area, and I heard that there had just been a development study, and they said, there is just no limit to what kind of growth we can have here in Martin County. we've got this and we've got that. And I said, let me ask you a question. Since we're not served by water or sewer here in the South County area,
mm-hmm.
how many straws can you put in the ground where you're also putting septic tanks here on the coast? And they said, well, it's a simple answer to that is that water resources wasn't included in our growth study. I said, how in God's name can you have an urban growth study or any kind of growth study without including water resources? Do you think they're going to be carrying this water in from Jeb's water reserves down in South America?
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, it's the simple answer is it just wasn't included in our study. So therefore, everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of myopic study is, I think, destined to do us a long-term harm.
Yeah, I don't know if you've been following the story of Lake Point Ranch in Western Martin County. This is a mining operation that got approved under the old Martin County Commission and has since... come under scrutiny by the new slow growth, for lack of a more nuanced term, commission. And the reason that now they're being scrutinized is because they are in discussions, very preliminary discussions, but discussions nonetheless, to basically clean some of the water from Lake Okeechobee on their property there and ferry it over to West Palm Beach. And you know, when you talk about sending water from your county to West Palm Beach, even if it is Lake Okeechobee water, which at certain times of the year we have a surplus of, it raises a lot of concerns. And the Lake Point Ranches people came in to talk to our editorial board the other day and defend these discussions, but you can see why it makes people nervous. And on top of that, Lake Point has sued the Martin County government for not upholding its end of the deal that they got approved for, and they sued Maggie Herchala, one of the iconic environmentalists from our county. I don't know that that does them any favors.
Well, you know, it's that new psychology where you slap the people you're looking for a favor from.
Yeah, and it is called a slap suit by the folks who disagree with it, a strategic lawsuit against public participation. And of course, the Lake Point folks denied that it's a slap suit. But Maggie Herchala is not a county commissioner anymore. She was speaking as a member of the public. So I will be interested to see how the courts respond to the lawsuit against her for speaking her mind, essentially.
And it may be an unfair question to ask you about politics, and if it is, just wave me off. But
okay.
I am curious what you hear at your listening post. You know, right now we've got a gubernatorial election coming up in a little while, with Charlie Crist being touted as the new Democratic hope. Do you think, from what you hear, that there's an interest in seeing him run as a Democratic candidate?
I think there's a lot of skepticism about Charlie Crist. You know, if you've ever met the man, and I have a couple times, he is incredibly charismatic, and you can see why people like him, but he's been pretty pliable, I'd say. And I don't know that people on either side of the aisle really like that. You know, most folks want someone with a backbone who will stand up for what they believe in. So I do think Charlie Crist is very interested in running, from what I can tell, but I don't know that he's going to get widespread support. And it's been very interesting watching Governor Scott shuffle around on various positions. I mentioned Everglades restoration, but that's just one of them. More recently, he proposed across-the-board raises for teachers, which I like the idea of, but you have to wonder if he's just trying to curry favor in advance of the election. There have been a couple other issues like that. So he's really positioning himself to the center of his own party and I guess anticipating a challenge from someone like Crist. But I haven't heard about a third option, but I suspect we will see something better arise before the gubernatorial election really heats up.
When we talked a little bit about this, the possible challenge of Charlie Crist for the Democrats, do you hear anything for a Republican challenger from Scott's right?
you know, there's rumblings, but I don't work in Tallahassee. I'm not dialed in to all those folks on a regular basis. I talked to our local lawmakers, and I really haven't pushed hard on getting some names out, but it would not surprise me. I think it's been very interesting to see Scott embrace the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, while his party has rejected it. So will they field a challenger on that issue alone? I don't know. Or has that been a bit of theater? So, because it does allow Scott to look like a moderate, knowing that it's not going to happen anyway. So we'll see what happens. I'm not on the inner circle of the Republican Party by any stretch. So
Scott, a man of the people.
What we'll see there. What's that?
I said, Scott, a real man of the people. Which way is the wind blowing right now? You never know. He may embrace Obama and look for some transportation funds. You never know.
You never know. Yeah, that would not surprise me at this point.
How do you see this year evolving? We've got so many interesting challenges. The legislature, are they going to find some new way of trying to outlaw women's access to health care? Do you hear any sense of what the conclusions of this legislature is going to be, or are you focused more on, you know, sort of regional issues rather than Tallahassee-oriented issues?
I will say that I am somewhat encouraged by the leadership we have in Tallahassee in the Senate right now. Don Gates came in, talked to our editorial board recently, and while I'm not aligned with him on a lot of issues, he is embracing some of the important things off the bat, like ethics reform. I think he knows what a bad reputation.
Did you say Jim Greer?
Right. I mean, it's been absurd. So just simple things like greater transparency on financial disclosure forms, a number of steps that should have been taken long ago. Gates is finally pushing those through, trying to make them happen. Weatherford, I think he's the House Speaker, and he's a younger guy, and he and Gates, it sounds like, have a good working relationship, and then they say they're not competitive with each other. But I don't know. Weatherford said something earlier this week that raised a red flag for me when he was discussing his reluctance to expand Medicaid. He mentioned that, I guess, he lost a sibling when he was a child, and his family didn't have health insurance. He mentioned a safety net that helped them out, but didn't specifically name it. Well, I believe it was the Tampa Bay Times came back and found out it was, in fact, Medicaid. So,
let's cut that now that I don't need it.
Yeah, that didn't make me feel too great. Don Gates, from what I can tell, is a relative moderate within the Republican Party. He was actually raising some concerns about sequestration, which a lot of Republicans have just wanted to brush off and not raise any concerns. But now Gates is from an area where there's a military base, and he's going to see more direct impacts from his constituents. So anyway, that's a long way of saying that I think we'll see ethics reform come through. There's going to be some election reform. I'll be curious to see how that plays out. You know, here on the Treasure Coast, in St. Lucie County specifically, Supervisor of Elections Gertrude Walker didn't certify her election results in time. And, of course, the whole Allen West, Patrick Murphy congressional race, it was a national story that played out as those results were contested. So we will see an effort to try to make Florida's ever challenged election system better. I'm not able to weigh in yet on the quality of what they're proposing because there's a lot of proposals out there.
One last question has to be asked before we leave the whole Republican agenda. Wasn't the timing of the closure of that trial just appropriate, so that none of those Republican officials got to be dragged into court to talk about the funds for the Florida Republican Party?
With Greer, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's another one I've just been a spectator on. I haven't written on that, but
talk about the nick of time, you know, huh?
Greer took the fall in that case. I'm not educated enough about the inner workings of that child to say more than that. But I don't think anyone wants to get too buddy-buddy with him.
That was one expensive sword to fall on, I guess. Well, Miss Samples, thank you so very much for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, Louise, tell me, my friend, did you enjoy tonight's show?
Oh, wonderful. It was quite a varied set of topics with very powerful women who are out there and are doing the darnest things.
Tell me, sir, what are you working on these days?
Well, right now we're really revamping our website and our strategies at Progressive Push. It's a matter of we think of it as evolving. We never think of ourselves as we got, you know, the one model. You do need a little bit of evolution to challenge the times and to work with what's out there, what's going on out there. And we are moving throughout the country. We are actually, in terms of candidates and that type of thing, preparing new venues for the to give candidates an opportunity to look into what they need to do to get elected and what they need to seriously work on ahead of time. And to give you an idea, you know, we're challenging candidates and says, you know, with a question such as, "You're running for office to do what?" To do exactly what? Don't give me a laundry list of issues. People don't want to know that. You know, they see those coming and going, but people want to know exactly what you're going to do. What needs to be fixed? What needs to be done? What are you going to bring in that is new? Are you creating something new? Are you expanding democracy? You know, is something that needs to be repaired? You need to talk to the voter in terms they understand, because that's, you know, that's what goes on. It's the just like we tell, you know, precinct leaders of the parties that they need to go out there, communicate with the neighbors, with the people who live in that prison, look at the potholes in a road and say, has somebody done anything about this? No, nobody. Well, why don't we get 10 or, you know, so many of you? Let's go to the city commissioner's office and talk to him. And when the city commissioner sees 10, 20 voters coming in the door and they are, you know, registered voters, you know, they listen. So that type of thing. We need those strategies to go out there. And people who want to run for office, if they're running for 2014, they need to be working on it right now, not 2, 3 months, 6 months right before the election. See, so we're trying to get them going on those things, and you know, some strategies that they can save themselves a lot of time and a lot of work. On the other hand, we're using social media to push so many of these important issues that if you were to spend 8 hours watching CNN, you wouldn't know anything about any one of them.
Yep.
Because they don't talk about anything that really is important in this country.
Yep. I've got one particular story I do want to tease before we get before we run out of time. Japanese experts say that up to 93 billion becquerels a day may be leaking into the Pacific from the Fukushima plant.
Yes.
A research group at Tokyo University of Marine Science and Technology did its own calculation in order to figure out why the density of cesium in the seawater inside the Fukushima plant harbor has remained at 100 becquerels per liter since the spring. According to the calculation, 44% of the seawater is replaced daily by current and tides. In order for that to happen, there must be 8 to 93 billion becquerels per day leaking into the harbor from the plants. An ongoing story. My brother, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you again soon.
Excellent.
Good night, everybody.
Enjoy. Goodbye.
Remember,
take care.
There's a better world coming. Thanks, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
They said the students scared the guards or the troops were battle dressed. The poor mothers in their new degree, the fashionable. I know we're all fed up with useless wars and racial strife. The next time they will ride, well, you best stay out of sight. When there's a ride going on, when there's a ride going on.
Good night, my friends. Talk to you next week.